Well, also, you can get this online, right?
You can get this online at WLRNradio.org or when you call us at 1-866-247-9576. I'll repeat that number. It's 1-866-247-9576 or WLRNradio.org.
I can't speak for the ladies, but I can certainly speak for the gentlemen, as you don't want to be late on Valentine's Day.
Well, I can speak for the ladies.
You don't want to have to stop by the 7-Eleven and get some little flowers.
Not to disparage 7-Eleven's flowers, but we can almost guarantee
that... Or on the street corner or whatever.
That's right. You never know what's going to be left at the last minute. Yeah, it's Thursday, and this opportunity to support public radio and get your flowers through us does end at 10 tomorrow morning. So why don't you help us out and help yourself out?
1-866-247-9576 or online at
WLRNradio.org.
Easy enough. Well, today we visit with University of California psychology professor Sonia Lyubomirsky. Is that right, Sonia?
That is right. Thank you.
She's the author of The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, and What Shouldn't Make You Happy Does. And she joins us now from a public station, KUCR, in Riverside, California. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, and good afternoon. So should happiness be the ultimate goal in our lives, or should it just be a byproduct of our lives?
Well, you know, most people want to be happy. Researchers go around the world asking people what their top goals in life are, and most people rate happiness at the top of their list. But recent research suggests that we don't want to make happiness sort of we don't want to be too preoccupied with that goal, that I think it works better when happiness is more of a byproduct, because otherwise we're sort of too focused on it. We don't want to keep monitoring our happiness. You know, am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? That could actually backfire.
So if you think about it too much, it's sort of like the basketball player at the end of the game that's at the free throw line. And if he has to think about it, it's going to be a brick.
That's right. In fact, there's lots of research on overthinking that shows that when we sort of think about almost anything too much, but especially ourselves and sort of negative things and, oh, am I happy yet? Oh, I'm not succeeding. Then that makes us just feel worse.
So explain the human emotional immune system and how it's similar to our body's immune system.
Sure. So a major theme of my book is what's called hedonic adaptation, which is basically the workings of what you can call the psychological immune system. And basically what that means is that human beings are remarkably good at getting used to changes in their lives, both positive and negative changes, but especially positive changes. So when we when we move into a new house, I just moved into a new house, and I think it took maybe a month to completely get used to the house and start taking it for granted. But even when we start a new relationship, start a new job, when we buy new stuff, we adapt to them relatively quickly. And so we need to kind of understand that that's a very human, ordinary process, and also sort of think about how we can try to thwart it sometimes.
What do you mean by we should thwart it?
Well, you know, when it comes to adaptation to positive things, like when we, like the truth is that we adapt to relationships and marriages, as well as we adapt to a new car, although it doesn't take as long. I mean, it takes longer to adapt to marriage. Most of us don't want to adapt to our spouse or our relationship. So there are ways that we can kind of slow down adaptation. We can sort of stave it off a little bit, although we can't stop it completely.
So which makes us happier, passionate love at the start of a relationship or what you refer to as companionate love over the long term?
You know, I'm not sure if I can answer that question because those two kinds of love are so different. So passionate love is it's kind of what the media tells us we all ought to be experiencing, right? When we read poetry, literature, watch movies, it's all about that kind of intense, the high highs of the beginning of a relationship, the honeymoon period. And so that certainly is wonderful kind of love. But companionate love is more this kind of deep friendship, liking, loyalty. I'm thinking of the movie Amour that came out recently that celebrates that kind of love in an older couple. I think the media would have us believe that passionate love is better, but I'm not sure if anyone really has sort of compared that one makes us happier than the other.
Mm-hmm. You talk about that a hot and heavy romantic relationship has about a 2-year vintage.
Well, so there's a famous study, and there's actually a few of them, that follow people across time before, like years before they get married. So say once a year, I ask you, how happy are you? And then you get married in the sort of years after. And so what the pattern is that, you know, as you approach the wedding day, you get a lot happier. Actually, the year before the wedding day is your sort of high point. That's kind of the honeymoon period. But then after about 2 years of marriage, people are back to where they started. They're sort of back to baseline. But although I should say that baseline is maybe already fairly high because you're in a relationship, so you're not unhappy. So clearly something changes, something, you know, so that maybe that passionate love is turning into companion love. We're not really sure what's happening. And also I should say there are a lot of individual differences. So some people are able to maintain their happiness after marriage for many years. Other people for even fewer than 2 years. So I'm really curious about what those couples are doing.
Tell us about that study that showed that surprise is more satisfying than stability and the implications of the study.
Sure. There's a number of studies. In one study, people were given a gift, but they weren't told sort of why they got it, what it was about. And so there's sort of this unexpected surprise element. So people actually stayed happier. It's kind of like that unopened present, you know, makes you happier than sometimes than when you actually after you open it, because then there's no uncertainty or surprise left. And then I've done some studies with my students showing that when people are given surprising feedback about their strengths, they stay happier longer. So there's something about surprise. Basically, when we're surprised, when there's uncertainty, when there's novelty, we try to figure it out. We try to understand it. And so that whole process of understanding actually maintains our positive mood. But once we sort of understand, you know, once there's no surprise left, then, you know, the kind of the mood dissipates.
Now, I was surprised in the book to read that studies show that women crave variety more than men. Now, is that across the board or is that sexual?
Well, I don't know. Actually, the only studies I know have to do with sexual arousal. And people are very surprised. I've gotten lots of emails about this finding. So studies, for example, ask men and women to rehearse sexual fantasies, or they present men and women with sexual images. And basically, women get bored faster. So it appears that they sort of require more novelty for sexual arousals, which is very, very interesting finding.
Very surprising.
Yeah.
So are committed or married partners happier than singles?
Well, okay, good question, because I think there's some misconceptions about that. It turns out that single people are actually very happy, are just as happy as married people. And I actually have a whole chapter in my book talking about how, because we often think like, oh, if we are single, if we don't find a partner, that we're going to be miserable. Actually, single people are not miserable at all. The comparison, it's when you compare married people to separated, widowed, divorced individuals, then the married people are much better off.
How about a sense of space? A lot of people would love to be, oh, I'd love to go to California and live where Sonia is, or come to Florida and live in the warm weather. But it turns out that after a while, people are just as happy in Indiana. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, the point, and again, one of the themes of my book, The Myths of Happiness, is that we adapt to almost everything, and we adapt to changes in weather and climate and location. And actually, there's a well-known study that was done in the Midwest and California with college students. And the researchers asked the college students, how happy do you think people in California are? And how happy do you think people in the Midwest are? And both of them thought that the folks in California are happier, but when they actually compared their happiness scores, they were the same.
Are expectations for happiness a big obstacle to being happy?
Yeah, I think expectations are really critical. In fact, I think that's one of the main mechanisms or explanations for why we adapt to things. So imagine, you know, like when you were younger, you know, maybe you lived in kind of a crappy little apartment with lots of roommates and you were perfectly happy with that. But then, you know, maybe you moved into your own apartment that was still not so nice, but it was nicer. And then you got used to that. And so your expectations rose. And so now you can't go back to the crappy old apartment. And then you maybe moved into an even better place or maybe bought your own home. And so the more your life improves, the more your standards rise. And also you start comparing yourself to other people who are kind of in your same income bracket. And so your aspirations or your expectations have a lot to do with your happiness, right? Because the higher they are, the more we need to maintain our current standard for us to remain happy.
But you say sometimes expectations are a good thing.
That's right. So, because it's a little bit of a puzzle, right? Because on the one hand, it's not good to have too high expectations, right? Because they can detract from happiness. On the other hand, there are situations, and what I describe in my book, situations where you're about to do something, like let's say you're about to give a presentation at work, or give a radio interview, or go on a date, ask someone else on a date. You want to have, in those situations, high expectations are really good to have, because they can turn into self-fulfilling prophecies. They can actually build confidence, right? You don't want to go on a date or about to give a presentation with low expectations. So I think in the domain of sort of day-to-day life, high expectations are good. But when you sort of think about your overall happiness, the way I like to say it is that we want to try to not have our expectations escalate too much. So try to prevent them from escalating every time something positive happens in your life.
We're speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky. She's the author of The Myths of Happiness on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by Art Wynwood, an international contemporary art fair President's Day weekend at the Art Miami Pavilion in the Midtown Wynwood Arts District. That's on Northeast 1st Avenue, February 14th through the 18th. Details at art-wynwood.com.
Calling all companies. The Mercedes-Benz corporate run is scheduled for April 4th in Fort Lauderdale, April 17th in West Palm Beach, and April 25th in Miami. All companies, large or small, are welcome to participate. This annual company event promotes camaraderie, team spirit, company morale, and introduces fitness to the community. A healthy employee makes for a healthy company. You could be part of one of the largest 5Ks in the U.S. Team packets and more information at MercedesBenzCorporateRun.com or 305-666-RACE.
Celebrate Valentine's Day and support WLRN at the same time by making a $100 contribution at WLRNradio.org.
As our thank you, we'll send your loved one 18 red roses, tastefully arranged from Field of Flowers.
All it takes is a $100 contribution at WLRNradio.org, and we'll send the roses anywhere in the Tri-County area in time for Valentine's Day, along with your personal message.
You're going to send the flowers. You want to support WLRN. Do them both now at WLRNradio.org or call 1-866-247-9577.
And 19 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with University of California psychology professor Sonia Lubomirsky. She's the author of The Myths of Happiness. Getting back, Professor, to talking about this human emotional immune system, how is it that somehow we are able to survive the unthinkable, the death of a child, debilitating illness, or being unexpectedly fired? Is somehow we handle it?
So you know, we've been talking about hedonic adaptation as something that applies to positive changes in our lives, like new relationships or new homes or cars. But the upside is that it also applies to negative changes. So people are remarkably resilient. That's one of the themes of my book, that people are just can adapt to lots and lots of negative changes and adversity as well. Not everything, I should say. So studies follow people across time, across many, many years. And again, they find that after, say, unemployment, divorce, even widowhood, people tend to kind of go back to their previous baseline. But for some events, like widowhood, for example, there's a study that was done with people who lost their spouses after many years. The widows and the widowers did rebound in happiness, but they never quite reached their previous level. So that adaptation was not complete. When you look at disability, it turns out that sort of moderate or mild disability people are able to adapt to, you know, very, very well, and they actually end up being as happy as they were before the disability, which is kind of amazing. But for severe disabilities, people never, on average, get back to their sort of previous baseline of happiness.
A while back, I had Mark Bonaconti on the program. He's the inspiration behind the Miami Project for Paralysis. He was injured in a college football game and is in a wheelchair. And I said, well, what would it be like if this injury hadn't occurred? And he said, well, I really don't think about that. I'm happy with my life the way it is and the events that have, it's made me such a much better person. And I don't really regret it at all.
And you hear that a lot. There's lots of studies of people coping with all kinds of adversity, illness, disability. And you know, what's remarkable is that human beings are just so good at kind of reframing their experience in a positive way. There's one study I'm thinking of women who have breast cancer, where two-thirds of them reported that the cancer actually was a positive change in their life. They say that they learned that they had strengths that they didn't know they had. You know, perhaps it's courage or humility or the ability to withstand pain. They learn who their true friends are. They sort of reprioritize what's important to them in life. So we just have this sort of amazing capacity to kind of positively reappraise our life situations and make the best of them. Not everyone, but sort of the average person seems to be able to do that.
So that would be the instance of what shouldn't make us happy but does.
That's right. And so, and actually that subheading is a little bit misleading, actually, because it doesn't mean that sort of it makes us happy to become disabled, but it just does. It doesn't make us as miserable as we think it will.
We're speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky about the myths of happiness today on Topical Currents. Should you want to join in the conversation, tell us what makes you happy or what makes you unhappy. The number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. We do have one emailer. Professor, women becoming bored or less aroused, says Evan, more quickly might just be a function of lesser sex drive. Did the survey experiment take this possible variation into account?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So I don't believe it did. So that's a possible explanation, right? So if you have lower libido, you may need kind of more stimulation. And actually, one of my favorite sex researchers has this quote, and she said that basically women are just not as into sex as men are, so their standards are higher. So she says, like, for example, if I don't like cake as much as you do, that cake better be kick butt for me to enjoy it. So that's kind of her theory of women's and men's sexuality.
Do many of us postpone our happiness? I know a lot of people say they're waiting for the right partner or the right job, and in the meantime, they're not happy. What do you suggest to those who wait?
Yeah. I actually make that point myself, that many of us are waiting for happiness, exactly, that we think, well, I'm not happy now, but I'll be happy when I find Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, or when I get that promotion I've always wanted, when I move to that city I always wanted to live in. And the problem is that those things do make us happy, but they don't make us happy for as long or as intensely as we think they will. We've already been discussing that. And really, I have a book before this one called The How of Happiness. I have a whole chapter on the importance of living in the present moment. You know, the present is all that we really ever have. And so we might as well make the best of it, you know, and not spend our time kind of dreaming about the future so much, and sort of savoring the moment, really enjoying the journey along the way rather than focusing on the goal, actually, is a really great strategy for happiness.
We have an emailer, Alyssa, wants to know if there's research that shows that pet owners are happier than people who live without pets.
I guess it depends on the pet.
Yeah. That's right. I bet there is, and I'm sorry, I'm not aware of it. I'm going to have to look that up. But I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, there's research on social support that shows how important support from others, close others, are to us in terms of our happiness and coping and even pain. And that work shows that having sort of your pet with you, for example, if you're ill, it makes you feel better. It kind of almost reduces your pain. So that's also called pet therapy sometimes. So I would bet that research is out there. I just don't know about it.
Okay. Does being a parent make one happy?
Ah, great question. I have a chapter on parenting. So, you know, the media has been really mixed about this, because you see articles saying, oh, well, parents are unhappy, they're miserable, and other articles saying, no, parenthood is great. So we actually published a study, my students and I and my collaborators, just this year. We have three different studies that showed that parents are actually a little bit happier than people who don't have children. their peers without children, and they report more meaning and purpose in their lives. But, you know, we also realize that question, whether parents are happier than people who don't have kids, is almost a meaningless one, because you really have to look at what kind of parent, right? You can't compare parents of newborns to parents of 30-year-olds. So we actually have written a paper since then that's kind of looking at all these different factors that might impact parenting. So, for example, we find that fathers are happier than men without children, but mothers aren't necessarily happier than women without children. They're about the same.
Is that because of a division of labor?
That's right. We think that maybe because mothers take on more of the burden of childcare. On the other hand, other studies show that women consider being a parent as a kind of a more important part of their identity, and they desire having children more. So that kind of argues against that. We also find that if you're married as a parent and if you're older, so basically being an older parent is really good, is for your happiness.
Well, you can address that. Tell us about your mid-40s pregnancy.
That's right. I'm pregnant right now at age 46 my fourth child. So I'm kind of one of those older parents, and I can guarantee you that the second time around, I have basically now, or will have, sort of two sets of kids separated by a decade, and the third one has been just a joy and much, much more happiness producing than the first two. I think there's just sort of this perspective that you have when you're older. You have more resources, you have more experience, you know what I mean? You have a sort of a whole
But you're still
attitude.
Dealing with a four-year-old when you're 50 then.
That is correct. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's great. Four-year-olds are really adorable. So we'll see. I guess ask me later. But we're not going to have the empty nest for a very long time.
I'd like to know about the genetics of happiness. Some people are so positive, it seems, no matter what's going on. Some are so negative, no matter what good is going on. How much of our happiness is genetic?
That's right. You know, quite a bit is. And so my first book, The How of Happiness, talked a lot about this. So there's a field called behavioral genetics. And what researchers do is they compare the happiness levels of identical twins and how similar they are to how similar are the happiness levels of fraternal twins. Identical twins share 100% of their DNA. Fraternal twins share 50%. And they find that identical twins are much more similar in their happiness levels. And this work suggests that happiness is in part genetically influenced. It's in part heritable. It's not everything, but, you know, when we look around us, we can see that some people are just naturally more positive, more optimistic, and happier than others. Those of us who have more than one child will notice. We feel like we're raising them the same way, and yet one is just naturally happier than another. So certainly part of the puzzle is genetics.
That reminds me, you mentioned Dan Gilbert in his book about happiness. In your book, I remember when he was on this program, he talked about that there were conjoined twins who chose not to have surgery to become independent because that's what they were happiest with.
Yeah, you know, and he talks about that in his book, The Stumbling
Unhappiness,
which is a great book. And that's actually very relevant to our discussion of adaptation, that you think like, wow, if I were a conjoined twin, that would be so horrible, right? I mean, that would be, how could I live a full life? And yet people, they get used to that kind of, to living with a conjoined twin and choose not to be separated. So I see that as a really amazing evidence for the power of hedonic adaptation.
Let's take a quick phone call. Our telephone number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email radio at WLRN.org. This is Alberto in Doral. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just have a quick question. Is there a relationship between how happy can you be and the level of intelligence that you have developed throughout your life?
Ah, interesting question. No, there is not. So happier people are no more intelligent than people who are less happy, but they're more productive at work and they make more money. So, and they seem to be better leaders, but there's no relationship with intelligence.
So ignorance isn't necessarily bliss.
That's right.
Yeah, I was wondering if people who were more self-aware are less happy than those who aren't.
Well, it turns out it depends what kind of self-awareness you're talking about. I actually spent about 10 years doing research on what's called rumination, which is sort of this circular dwelling and kind of, overthinking and ruminating about yourself and your problems. That kind of awareness or introspection is not good. That actually makes people unhappy. But if you're talking about more of a kind of a philosophical, intellectual introspection or self-awareness or self-reflection, then that is positively related to happiness.
Hmm. You just mentioned money. We need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out if money makes us happy. It's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky, The Myths of Happiness. We'll be right back.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Auto Direct, committed to making the car and truck leasing process easier, offering all makes and models of vehicles with real quotes right over the phone. Quotes and additional information at theperfectpayment.com and 800-615-1087.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner, and you can show that special someone in your life how much they mean to you by giving to WLRN.
Make a contribution of $100, and WLRN will send your spouse or significant other a beautiful arrangement of 18 red roses, along with your personal message from Field of Flowers.
And they'll be delivered in time for Valentine's Day, anywhere in Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach counties.
It's a great way to take care of your loved one and help WLRN at the same time.
You can give online at WLRNradio.org or by calling 1-866-247-9576. Thanks.
Cleveland Clinic Florida is dedicated to bringing world-class heart care close to you in South Florida. Cleveland Clinic Florida provides individualized and innovative treatment plans, and the expert team treats cardiovascular problems ranging from the most common to the most complex, even in cases considered untreatable by others. Same-day appointments are available in Weston and West Palm Beach. Details at 1-800-639-DOCTOR or at clevelandclinicflorida.org.
Welcome back to Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper and Sonia Lubomirsky. We're speaking about her latest book, The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. So, as we said before the break, what about money? Does research show that if you have greater means, you're happier than if you don't?
I bet it depends. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's such a complicated question to answer. Actually, I have a whole section in my book kind of giving sort of the bottom line. And so sort of to put it simply, that money does make you happy. So people who have more are happier. But the difference between sort of wealthy people and poor people is greatest sort of at the lower end. So basically, money makes you really happy if it keeps you from being poor. But even at the higher end, I mean, what's amazing is that if you make $500,000 a year, you're happier than someone who makes $400,000, and that person is happier than someone who makes $200,000. So even at the high end, it makes a difference. But what the big point kind of that I make is that what matters is what you spend your money on, and it's really, you need to sort of spend money in ways that make you happy.
So explain that.
Sure. I guess one of the biggest findings is that spending money on experiences makes people happier than spending money on possessions or things, right? So getting back to hedonic adaptation, when we buy something, a thing, a possession, a material good, we tend to, you know, we put it on the shelf, we put it in the closet, we put it in the garage, and we adapt to it fairly quickly. But when we spend money on experiences, maybe a vacation or a dinner or something you sort of enjoy as an experience, a massage, where we don't adapt to it as quickly. We don't tend to compare it with other people. Like when I go on vacation, I don't tend to compare my vacation to my friend's vacation. I just enjoy my vacation or a concert or something like that. And then actually the biggest find, that I think the most important finding is if you spend your money on anything that helps you grow as a person, so it could be learning a new skill, a new language, anything that helps you connect with others, so taking out your friends to dinner or something like that, and then anything that helps you contribute to your community, to help others, to contribute to charity, those are ways of spending money that makes people very happy.
Why do trivial hassles bother us more than major traumas? I'm more upset by a delayed flight than maybe finding that my sister is scheduled for surgery.
You know, that's right. And, you know, and think about like yesterday. You know, what made you happy yesterday? Was it the fact that you're married? Was it the fact that
you should have been listening yesterday to this program?
Oh, I wasn't.
We had big technical problems.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so it was the technical problems that made you unhappy, not the how much money you have in the bank, right? It was those hassles,
right.
So getting stuck in traffic or being late with a deadline. And I think in part the reason is because when something big happens to us, we're like, okay, like we prepare for it. We muster all our resources. I remember one day I was in a car accident. It was fine, but I mean, it was a major accident, but I was fine. But I was like, okay, I got to deal with this. You know, I got social support from friends. I had sort of my psychological resources. But when little things happen, you know, you don't get social support for friends for that. You know, they kind of get bored listening to you. Oh yeah, you got stuck in traffic again. We sort of don't, I don't know, I guess we don't expend as much energy coping with the little things.
You mentioned giving to charity. Isn't making others happy and helping others a tremendous part of what gives us happiness?
That's right. You know, what I was talking about before, about when you spending your money on anything that sort of contributes to others, to the community, to society, makes people happy. One of my favorite studies gave people $20 in the morning. And they, the researchers said, okay, you can go and spend those $20 either on, one group was told, spend it on yourself, anything you want, or another group was told, spend it on other people. And the group that spent it on other people were happier at the end of the day than the group that spent it on themselves.
Interesting. Do you want to tell us what's making you happy? You can call us at 1-800-743-9576 or not.
Or what's not making you happy.
Or not making you happy. Or you can email radio at WLRN.org. We do have an emailer, just an intelligent listener, who wants to know, are there changes in expectations for happiness as we become elderly?
That's a great question. So one of the myths of happiness that I talk about is that, oh, I'll be miserable when I'm old. You know, a lot of us are dreading old age. Turns out that older people are happier than younger people. They have fewer negative emotions. And the research suggests that older people, in a sense, are emotionally wiser. It's like they know what makes them happy, what makes them unhappy, what individuals make them unhappy or happy, and they sort of tend to spend time doing things or being with people who make them happy. And they're, in terms of their expectations, I don't know of any studies that directly compare them, but I wouldn't be surprised also if their expectations are different. They're not as sort of escalating, they're not as high. They're much more grateful, you know, for what they have.
That's
than
funny.
Our younger people.
As I get older, it seems like I'm more easily annoyed.
Sounds like a topic for another show.
Yeah, maybe you're an outlier, but most older people are. Yeah, they're less easily. It's kind of like you've been through everything, right? You've seen it all, and so nothing really gets you. When you're young, like you get stressed about little things. So yeah, I think older people are essentially emotionally wiser.
How about touching, Professor, on ultradian dips and rhythms?
Oh, so it turns out, you know, most people have heard of the circadian rhythm. You know that we. Cycle, you know, we go to sleep and then we're awake during the day. Well, it turns out there's something called the ultradian rhythm. And so basically what this research suggests is that every like 60 to 90 minutes, we have a short period, maybe 20 minutes of kind of low energy, lethargy, maybe even, you don't feel so great, maybe even low mood. And so what's interesting about that is that we should all just be aware of that. Like throughout our work day, there may be, you know, every 90 minutes or so, maybe sometimes 2 hours, we have this sort of period of low energy. And so when we have that period, we should not try to work maybe through it, because that'll just make us feel kind of burnt out and we might end up making errors, but just kind of relax, you know, take a walk, you know, chat with a colleague, kind of get through it. Until the next ultradian dip comes along.
As a writer, how did that ultradian dip and rhythms affect your writing?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I actually, when I wrote this last book, I did it instead of these bursts of 90 minutes to 2 hours. I almost never work more than 2 hours at a time. I actually went to a writing place. It's kind of like a coffee house without coffee, just for writers. And that worked really great. And I actually, at the time, that was before I did the research on the ultradian dips. I hadn't realized that actually kind of how wise that is, that we have sort of the highest like energy and alertness for a period of time, and then we really need a break.
What about religion and spirituality? How important are they to our happiness? Are there studies with that, research in that area?
There absolutely are. In The How of Happiness, in my book, The How of Happiness, I have a chapter on religion and faith and spirituality. It turns out that religious and spiritual people are happier than those who are not. And that's a pretty robust finding. But the question really is why? And it turns out there's really two reasons. One is that religious people tend to have better social support. They have stronger families, stronger communities, and it often is sort of their kind of religious community. And also religious people report more purpose and meaning in life, and especially when they're coping with adversity. So one of my conclusions from that work is that, you know, you don't have to be religious to have purpose and meaning in life and to have a good, really good social support and strong relationships, but faith is sort of one way that people obtain those things.
And we'll take another call. This is listener Gina. She's in Boca Raton. Hi.
Hi, it's great talking to you today. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Okay,
my observation was this. It was about money. And my concern over that is that I think money is such an overriding factor with happiness. And your guest today even said in her stats, she noticed that people with more money were more happy. But I think this is a thread that is woven in every other category, and that's the problem I'm having with the stats overall, if that makes sense. For example, parenthood. Parenthood is very enjoyable, and it brings a lot of happiness, and the stats are higher for parents as compared to non-parents. However, you do need resources. You do need money to start a family. And I was just wondering what your comments were on that.
No, thank you for that question. And it's true. I mean, money's kind of interwoven with every aspect of life. You know, interestingly, with parenthood, you know, if you're employed and you're married, you're happier as a parent than if you're not. And that probably has something to do with the resources, kind of having more resources and help and assistance and support. But for example, the most recent studies show that the high SES parents, the high socioeconomic status parents, the really well-off parents, are actually less happy than people who are really well-off without children. And it turns out that, well, the kind of the theory is that if you're wealthy, the opportunity costs of your time are much higher. So spending time, you know, playing a board game with a kid is sort of not, you know, not as enjoyable because you could be making a lot of money with that hour you would spend on your kid. So that actually kind of goes the opposite way. But I think the listener was absolutely right. I mean, money is really interwoven with everything. And as I make it clear in my chapter on money, you know, when you're at the point where you really need resources to kind of have your basic needs met, and, you know, as you say, to start a family, to start a marriage, then money is really, really critical. It's really at the highest ends that money isn't as critical. But as I said, it still shows that people who are even really, really wealthy are happier than people who are only a little bit wealthy. And in part, that's because our expectations rise. You know, the wealthier we are, the more we want, and the more we associate with other people with similar wealth or more. There's always someone who has even more than us. So,
how about the happiness of finding a $20 bill in a pair of pants that you haven't worn in a long time?
Well, those, you know, the little things we talked about. The little things often make us happier than the big things. We talked about hassles, but same thing for uplift. So, when you think about yesterday, what made you happy? It might have been like, oh, you had a great sandwich, or, you know, the sun came out and you enjoyed that. Or you got an unexpected phone call from an old friend. It's those little things, or you found a $20 bill. Those little things contribute to your daily happiness more than the big things.
We're speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky. The Myths of Happiness is her latest book, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. Take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Back in just a moment to Topical Currents here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. Thanks for joining us today. Laughing Matters at the Broward Center combines dinner theater with the hilarity of topical satire in a one-of-a-kind evening that everyone may enjoy. Laughing Matters takes on every subject from the latest scandal, social media, current events, to everything in between. Laughing Matters, now playing. Tickets at 954-462-0222 or browardcenter.org. We're funded by listeners like you and by ConservArt, offering professional restoration and conservation of the fine art and collectibles for over 50 years. Custom framing and insurance claims handling are specialties. More information is online at conservart.net.
Give a gift to WLRN today and receive as our gift to you a beautiful arrangement of 18 red roses delivered to your loved one in time for Valentine's Day.
Here's how it works. Give $100 at WLRNradio.org and we'll make sure the flowers are delivered anywhere in the Tri-County area in time for Valentine's Day, or send 30 roses for $150.
You'll support the WLRN programs you value, and that special person in your life will get a fabulous Valentine's gift.
Send it along now at WLRNradio.org or call 1-866-247-9576.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And if you're not the last minute Louie and you want to take advantage of our Valentine's Day flower program, that number is 1-866-247-9576. Make someone else happy.
Or radio, or WLRNradio.org. Yeah, make somebody else happy. It makes you feel good. And Sonia Lubomirsky, what website, what are your websites or places people can find out more about you?
Sure.
In the books?
Well, there's two that are, I guess, the main ones. And one is called drsonia.net, which is kind of a funny title, drsonia.net, because that contains kind of all my websites, and including themythsofhappiness.org for the latest book, themythsofhappiness.org. And I also have a website that's connected to all of those that's part of my academic sort of faculty at University of California Riverside page, where listeners can find all my scholarly papers. Some people are interested in reading the original empirical papers, and they're all on there as well.
Let's take another caller. This is Susanna. She's in Miami. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Susanna.
Hi, Susanna.
Hi, yes. I'm a young mother. I have a 19-year-old daughter, a wonderful teenager in college. She's amazing, and she made me happy. I desire my daughter. Sadly, I can't remember. She was one of the things that I wished since I was a kid. I want to have a kid, and that was my main goal in life, right? Well, I have many different goals now, and but one thing I know that don't make me happy is that I struggle with my past. I have problems letting go. And I just would like to have, you know, any suggestions. I've been in therapy and, you know, always trying to be a better person. For the most part, I'm very happy. I'm a very happy person. But it's like kind of genetic, a lot of depression in my family and a lot of negativity.
Well, thank you so much for that question. I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer a question like that. Because I'm not a psychotherapist. But I think professional help can be really, really useful, especially kind of when coping with issues from the past. But I can say that there's a lot of very simple strategies that all of us can undertake in our daily lives that can kind of address some of these issues, and they have to do with, and a lot of them are described in both of my books, The Myths of Happiness and The How of Happiness. For example, just sort of practicing gratitude in our everyday life, practicing trying to be more optimistic about the future, trying not to dwell, you know, on the past or on negative things, distract yourself from when you find yourself ruminating or dwelling. Being more forgiving helps a lot of people. Practicing your spirituality. Physical exercise is also really, really valuable, as is meditation, at least for people who enjoy that. So there are a lot of simple kind of what I call positive activities we can all undertake. But sometimes we need more help than that. We need kind of to get professional help as well.
Touch on, Professor, it's time to make a decision whether we use our gut instinct or whether we use more rational methods.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a, you know, when Malcolm Gladwell published his book, Blink, I think the idea became, which I think is a great book, but the idea became popular that sort of gut instinct decisions are superior to sort of those where we really reason things out. And I think, and it's really true for some domains. I mean, there's certain situations where, you know, just kind of your gut instinct is the best one. But I think for the kinds of decisions that I talk about in my book about, you know, whether about getting married or getting divorced and having children and quitting a job or staying in a job, I think those kinds of decisions, your gut often tells you the wrong thing. That's where the myths of happiness come in, where we feel like, oh no, like if I get divorced, I'll be miserable forever. Now, I'm not telling that we should all get divorced, but some in many situations, that is the right decision. And so I actually argue for the importance of really, you know, sitting down and thinking through and reasoning and making kind of more rational decisions based on reason and based on experience.
We have another emailer. Isabel wants to know if you studied inner-generated happiness. It seems all is outside-generated. But you've talked... go ahead.
Yeah, I've talked a lot about the inner-generated happiness. I mean, when we talk about money, that's sort of outside, right? So we know that that makes us happy, at least for a little bit. But most of what I've talked about actually is, it really comes from the inside. In fact, it's kind of a cliche, right, that happiness comes from the inside. I mean, trying to be more grateful, not escalating your expectations, deciding, for example, what I talked about, spending your money on things that connect with others or helping others. Those are all inner-generated. Those are all sort of choices that we make.
Which do we regret more, the things we haven't done or the things we have?
Ah, well, maybe we could let listeners sort of think about what they think, what their instinct is to, in mm-hmm. answering that question. I think we do have the right instinct. So we regret more the things that we haven't done more than the things we did. And when you think about that, like think about, you know, things you regret from your past. Maybe you had kind of a bad relationship, which most of us have had, you know, and you regret that. Or maybe you invested your money in some way that you regret. Well, the thing about those kinds of things, the things that we've done and we regret them, is that they're pretty easy to rationalize and to explain to ourselves. Maybe that bad relationship helped you grow as a person, and it's sort of right. part of your identity. It's part of who you are. And you can kind of say, well, I was immature then. I was just learning. And that investment of money, you can kind of explain away by, you know, I don't know, you got some bad advice. But the things that you haven't done are really hard to rationalize. Imagine maybe you were in love once and you really didn't pursue that person sort of as hard as you should have. And then now they're married to someone else, and that opportunity to be with them is gone forever. You know, it's hard to kind of rationalize that. So opportunities that we did not take, or maybe we had an opportunity to go to live in Europe and take a job there, and we never took it. We regret that. It's really hard to rationalize that to ourselves. So in the end, we tend to regret the things that we have not done.
How about the importance of confidants? I've read that every person should have someone that they can tell absolutely everything too.
Yes. So, you know, we touched on this before about the importance of social support. You know, when we're sad, when we're dealing with stress, when we're dealing with adversity, especially having a confidant, having a close other friend, family member, even a pet I mentioned before, is incredibly helpful.
I'll tell the pet anything.
yeah, that's right. You can talk to a pet. You can talk to a plant too, I guess, but the pet is even better. One of my favorite studies is they had people judge how steep a hill was. And if you had a friend with you, you judged the hill as less steep than if you were alone. And that's a great kind of almost like a metaphorical finding that you sort of, you know, adversities, stresses are not as obstacles are not as steep when you have a friend or a confidant.
How important is it to set goals in our lives?
Really important. A lot of happiness, a lot of research that shows that people are happier when they're pursuing meaningful, significant goals. And again, because as we talked about before, it turns out sort of the journey, that pursuit may be more important than the actual achievement of the goal. Because once we achieve the goal, then, you know, we adapt to it, then we want to achieve the next goal,
right.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? That's how we make progress. Now, it's also important to choose the right kind of goals. So intrinsic goals, those are goals that I talked about before, that help you grow as a person, contribute to others, connect with others. Those are going to be make you much happier than what are called extrinsic goals. Those are goals where you're seeking wealth, power, fame, beauty. Those kinds of goals don't tend to make people happy.
Well, perhaps if I win the lottery, I'll be able to test some of your theories about money.
Yeah, that's
and
what my
happiness.
Husband says. My husband argues with me. He's like, I really will be happy when I win the lottery. And I tell him about the divorce rate, you know, is higher among people who win lotteries. So.
Oh, is that true?
Also, the divorce rate of second marriages is higher than the first.
Yeah. And
well, usually the third one, doesn't the third one usually stick?
You know, I don't know.
By the third, you ought to just be prohibited. Denied a license.
Sonia Lubomirsky, again, give us your websites, your latest book, The Myths of Happiness. What is your website?
Sure. So the easiest one is themythsofhappiness.org. Just one word, themythsofhappiness.org. Thank you.
Okay.
We've been speaking with University of California Riverside psychology professor Sonia Libomirsky. She's the author of The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy Does. Happy day, professor.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. You too.
And thanks for listening this afternoon. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also find author and book links such as today's and discussion and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. That should make you happy. Thursday, we return for a special Valentine's edition, which includes Linda Gassenheimer, wine columnist Fred Tasker, and the renowned Martha Stewart. And to the calendar, on this day in 1926, 87 years ago, the birth of ball player and broadcaster Joe Gargiola in St. Louis. He grew up on the same street as Yogi Berra, went on to host the Today Show and broadcast World Series games for many years. And on this day in 1955, 58 years ago, the birth of comedian and talk host Arsenio Hall in Cleveland. In 1987, he replaced Joan Rivers as host for Fox Network Late Night Talk Show. And one more, on this day in 1964, 49 years ago, the Beatles play Carnegie Hall. They arrived in a beat-up taxi to avoid the fan swarm and played 2 one-hour shows. Outrageous. Tickets were $4. And we leave with a thought from Beatle John Lennon when asked that day if the group was a fad, quote, "Oh, obviously, anything in this business is a fad. I mean, we don't think we're going to last forever. We're just going to have a good time while we last, you know." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.